Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is Now or Never, and that debt is fraud. And you'd be amazed how many people, when they hear those words, their ears, you know, may the eardrums may actually create the vibrations and so forth. So you hear it, but you're not listening. And so when a person's actually listening and receives the information and then processes it, you'd be surprised how many people are absolutely dumbfounded. What do you mean that's fraud? It says right there in the Constitution, the federal government has the full faith and credit. Yeah, over everything in that Constitution. They don't have the full faith and credit to subsidize communism throughout the world. Are you kidding me? So when people, you know, every time I engage, there's always a few people that hear it for the first, they understand it for the first time. They're going, wow. We don't owe that money at all. I mean, and no, that's a fear tactic. Everybody's been working together to collapse the system. So I'm not sure if you heard, Sean, welcome back. I believe it was announced by the Treasury not too long ago that the United States government is insolvent.
Again?
Yeah, well, I mean, so right now they're trimming down the deficit. I don't know if they've removed the deficit, not if, you know, we've just signed off another multi-trillion dollar, you know, infrastructure package. I mean, that's unconstitutional money right there that they're spending. And so let's kind of look at this. They've gone through this. They've even declared bankruptcy. I believe, folks, that this next debt crisis, the next financial crisis, when everybody says, you know what, we want our pound of flesh, United States, we're done. That's when the capitulation will try to occur. If you have not reached and rattled the heads of your state legislatures to say, look, they're spending money on things they have no authority. I mean, wasn't it yesterday we kind of talked about that dangerous amendment of a balanced budget amendment? And however, oh, that sounds like a good idea. Oh, yeah. Oh, let's do that. It still takes on debt. And it still allows unconstitutional spending. The system and the Constitution was done in such a way that they had to come up with a way of paying for any debt that they were going to take on. But that's not what they do. They just create spending bills without creating the appropriation for that. Why? Because nobody really wants to pay for the good. I mean, everybody wants to go to the party, but who wants to pay for it? Especially, you know, when it's a party. I mean, and you can take advantage and have a real good time. Anyway. Anywho, so it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. And I hope, I hope this is all making sense. And I hope that you're getting a lot out of this year's going through the notes on the Constitution Convention. Because if I could speak for Sean, I know he is. And even Tammy. And as a matter of fact, like I said, every time you read these things, if you've gone through it once or twice, or actually two, three times, you go, oh, I'm familiarized with it. But there's always these little things that jump out. Because even this year, I found at least once I made a big announcement. Oh, that's a big thing. I never noticed that before. No, it was a few weeks ago, and I have lost all sorts of other memories, including that, since then. But anywho, where we left off, we are still on, let me see here, we are still on August. No, this is not right. Oh, this pisses me off. So where did we leave off?
I believe we're on August 13th.
I want to say it was August 19th, farther than that. And I'm sorry, folks, because I was just complaining to Sean that my system crashed on me, and it caused me problems because I had these things open. Yes. All right, so interesting. That is there. Okay. All right, so I captured that, but I didn't capture the stopped part. Okay, so we are on 18, and I think Tammy covered the red part, and then you started covering the blue part, and then you guys were going back and forth through the yellow part. And just so everybody can kind of see this, and I think this is, we covered down past the assumption of debt, which is Mr. Ellsworth, Mr. Rutledge. I think we just went through the votes and the king, and actually, I think what we hadn't read was Mr. Rutledge. Now, let me ask you this. Nope, I don't remember the TOCPM acronym. Anybody struggling on that? So that's where we left off. Because I know that, for the most part, they identified the committee and who was going to be in the committee. And then I think we kind of went into conversation and end of show. Are you with me where I'm at? You're probably not.
Can you give me a page number?
Yeah, 325. I'm sorry, 325. And this is at the very end of the yellow. And I don't even know if it's yellow. So this is Mr. Rutledge, and it's kind of in the middle of 325. Mr. King, actually, I'll give you the names. It was Mr. Gary, Mr. King, and then Mr. Rutledge in that order. And so it kind of starts off with remarked on the length of the session.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm there.
Sorry. All right. So that's where we left off. And, boy, I'm glad I had the brain cells to remember. Okay, so let's go ahead and go through this, and then while you're doing that, I'll go up to what the... Okay, so this is... They're talking about Mr. Gary's motion to provide public securities for stages, post roads, and for letters of marquee and reprisal and that type of stuff, and that's when they decided to create the committee, so let's go ahead. Mr. Rutledge.
Mr. Rutledge remarked on the length of the session, the probable impatience of the public, and the extreme anxiety of many members of the convention to bring the business to an end, concluding with a motion that the convention meet henceforward precisely at 10 o'clock a.m., and that precisely at 4 o'clock p.m. the president adjourn the House without motion for the purpose, and that no motion to adjourn sooner should be allowed.
Okay, so in other words, they need to start really working, and, you know, 10 to 4, that's a six-hour day, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I guess they didn't have eight-hour day standards back then. Okay, so on the question, were they going to form this committee, and only Pennsylvania and Maryland voted against it. So in other words, they were going to form this committee, and they were going to basically do... work out these issues of deciding what to do regarding the post roads and what to put into the Constitution for those things, letter marquee and all of that. Okay, so now we just go a little bit further down, and they bring up the conversation, because remember, it was the first time they brought up militia was, you know, in August time frame, and it was still in August, but I think it was Mason that brought up the militia. So now they're focusing a little bit more on the militia. So Mr. Gary basically starts off with, let's go. You know what? I don't think, so is this blue for you? I just want to make sure this is highlighted blue for you.
No, it is not.
Okay, so this is where Mr. Gary took notice that there is no check here against standing armies of peace. Not at all. That's not... Are you?
Oh, okay. Now I see it. Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay. Great. So that's where we are. Okay. So let's pick up there, right there.
Okay. Mr. Gary took notice that there is no check here against standing armies in time of peace. The existing Congress is so constructed that it cannot of itself maintain an army. This would not be the case under a new system. The people were jealous on this head, and great opposition to the plan would spring from such an omission. He suspected that preparations of force were now making against it. He seemed to allude to the activity of the governor of New York at this crisis in disciplining the militia of that state. He thought an army dangerous in time of peace and could never consent to a power to keep up an indefinite number. He proposed that there shall not be kept up in time of peace more than 1,000 troops. His idea was that the blanks should be filled with 2,000 or 3,000. Instead of to build and equip fleets to provide and maintain a navy, agreed to as a more convenient definition of power. No contest. Agreed to no contest as a more convenient definition of the power. Quote, to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces, end quote, added from the existing Articles of Confederation.
Okay, great. So, so interestingly enough, they were already, you know, now that they were covering militia, there were grumblings on the outside. Oh, ho, 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 hey, we want to make sure that they don't have a standing army. And so they hadn't even come up with why they would call forth the army. So there are some discussions that need to be had. But interestingly enough, it was a blank check for the Navy. And why was the Navy a blank check? Because the Navy would not be a threat to the land, the people, you know, because they're a strategic, external, outfacing. The only way people are going to come to America from Europe is over that water. Now, they could go to Canada or Mexico and or Florida and kind of come up that way, but they wouldn't be able to go right into the heart of a city. Go look at the Canadian border at this point in time and look at the southern border of America. At this point in time, they didn't even have New Orleans yet, right? So Georgia was the farthest south, and Atlanta, and most all of the primary, you know, where people were living and where there was a concentration of forces was, you know, in harbors and places where they could effectively do trade without having to haul too much stuff too far. So the Navy was just like, okay, it's stupid to think that we wouldn't want that type of strategic protection. But they were clear that they wanted to make sure that there was going to be a full limitation on the army. They even added, or Gary was adding, Eldridge Gary was basically saying, hey, we want to make sure that they can't have any more than this many troops in times of peace. Okay? And so then he also included, and that's kind of, if you ask me, they were just carrying it over. So it was one of those things that nobody dare probably make a contest over the making the rules of government and the regulations of the land and naval forces. Okay, that's boom. And so they kind of moved on. So Mr. Martin and Mr. Gary basically did this. They basically moved, quote, provided that in time of peace, the army shall not consist more than 1,000 men. It doesn't say 1,000. They don't have a number. They're just 1,000 men. And so General Pinckney, I'm just going to kind of read these short balls here, asked whether no troops were ever to be raised until an attack should be made on us. Because now, what's that identifier in front of his name? General? So this guy's looking at this from a military perspective. Well, we have to have forces. We have to maintain some kind of army. Well, again, as it was already said by Eldridge Gary, there are plenty of people, governors and so forth, that do not want to see a national force. It's one thing for the states to have their own militia. And if they're attacked, then the states will deal with that. But what's the need for having a federal army all the time? It's not like the states are going to be giving up, or at least under this new system that they do create. The states don't give up their militia. They're supposed to maintain them. Okay, so Mr. Williamson reminded him of Mr. Mason's motion for limiting the appropriation of revenue as the best guard in this case. And Mr. Langdon, I think he's from New York, saw no room for Mr. Gary's distrust of the representatives of the people. Okay, so I'll let you go ahead and then go through Dayton, Mason, General Pinckney, and then down to Ellsworth, and then the Mr. Mason. We can stop on where Mr. Mason or Sherman seconds the motion, right there.
Okay, sir. Okay,
thank you.
So, Mr. Dayton, preparations for war are generally made in peace, and a standing force of some sort may, for aught we know, become unavoidable. He should object to no restrictions consistent with these ideas. The motion of Mr. Martin and Mr. Gary was disagreed to, no contest. Mr. Mason moved as an additional power to make laws for the regulation and discipline of the militia of the several states, reserving to the states the appointment of the officers. He considered uniformity as necessary in the regulation of the militia throughout the Union. General Pinckney mentioned a case during the war in which a dissimilarity in the militia of different states had produced the most serious mischiefs. Uniformity was essential. The states would never keep up a proper discipline of their militia. Mr. Ellsworth was for going as far in submitting the militia to the general government as might be necessary, but thought the motion of Mr. Mason went too far. He moved that the militia should have the same arms and exercise and be under rules established by the general government when in actual service of the United States. And when states neglect to provide regulation for militia, it should be regulated and established by the legislature of the United States. The whole authority over the militia ought by no means to be taken away from the states, whose consequence would pine away to nothing after such a sacrifice of power. He thought the general authority could not sufficiently pervade the Union for such a purpose, nor could it accommodate itself to the local genius of the people. It must be vain to ask the states to give the militia out of their hands.
Okay, so Mr. Sherman seconds the motion, but what motion is he seconding? It's actually Mr. Mason's motion, just a couple of paragraphs up, where Mr. Mason moved as an additional power, quote, to make laws and regulations for discipline, to insert that language. So he was in favor of doing that. So now Mr. Dickinson comes back and go ahead and kind of read through. Just go all the way down, until we get to the vote, as they debate these couple of motions that they're in front of them. Go ahead.
Mr. Dickinson, we are come now to a most important matter, that of the sword. His opinion was that the states never would nor ought to give up all authority over the militia. He proposed to restrain the general power to one-fourth part at a time, which by rotation would discipline the whole militia. Mr. Butler urged the necessity of submitting the whole militia to the general authority, which had the care of the general defense. Mr. Mason had suggested the idea of a select militia. He was led to think that would be, in fact, as much as the general government could advantageously be charged with. He was afraid of creating insuperable objections to the plan. He withdrew his original motion and moved a power, quote, to make laws for regulating and disciplining the militia, not exceeding one-tenth part in any one year, and reserving the appointment of officers to the states, end quote. General Pinckney renewed Mr. Mason's original motion, for a part to be under the general and part under state governments would be an incurable evil. He saw no room for such distrust of the general government. Mr. Langdon seconds General Pinckney's renewal. He saw no more reason to be afraid of the general government than of the state governments. He was more apprehensive of the confusion of different authorities on the subject than of either. Mr. Madison thought the regulation of the militia naturally appertaining to the authority charged with the public defense. It did not seem in its nature to be divisible between two distinct authorities. If the states would trust the general government with the power over the public treasure, they would, from the same consideration or necessity, grant it the direction of the public force. Those who had a full view of the public situation would, from a sense of the danger, guard against it. The states would not be separately impressed with the general situation, nor had the due confidence in the concurrent exertions of each other. Okay. Mr. Ellsworth considered the idea of a select militia as impracticable, and if it were not, it would be followed by a ruinous declension of the great body of the militia. The states will never submit to the same militia laws. 3 or 4 shillings as a penalty will enforce obedience better in New England than 40 lashes in some other places. Mr. Mm-hmm. Pinckney thought the power such as one could not be abused, and that states would see the necessity of surrendering it. He had, however, but a scanty faith in militia. There must also be a real military force. This alone can effectually answer the purpose. The United States have been making an experiment without it, and we see the consequences in their rapid approaches towards anarchy. Mr. Sherman took notice that the states might want their militia for defense against invasions and insurrections and for enforcing obedience to their laws. They will not give up this point. In giving up that of taxation, they retain a concurrent power of raising money for their own use. Mr. Gary thought this the last point remaining to be surrendered. If it be agreed by the convention, the plan will have as black a mark as was set on Kane. He had no such confidence in the general government as some gentlemen professed, and believed it would be found that the states have not. Colonel Mason thought there was great weight in the remarks of Mr. Sherman, and moved an exception to his motion, quote, of such part of the militia as might be required by the states for their own use, end quote. Mr. Reed doubted the propriety of leaving the appointment of the militia officers in the states. In some states, they are elected by the legislatures, and others by the people themselves. He thought at least an appointment by the state executives ought to be insisted on. On committing to the Grand Committee last appointed, the latter motion of Colonel Mason and the original one revived by General Pinckney.
Okay, so New Hampshire, yes. Massachusetts, yes. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, yes. Delaware, yes. Maryland, no vote because they were divided. Virginia, yes. North Carolina, yes. South Carolina, yes. And Georgia, yes. So it was 8-2. And so out of, what, 11 voting because they had... New York, somebody was there from, oh, actually, no, that's the one that they didn't have still. No Hamilton or anybody else had voted. So, okay, let's just kind of do a recap of how this all kind of started. As they started going out, and let me ask you this, did some of these points make sense?
Yes, sir.
And some of the counterpoints made sense, too.
On both sides.
Yes, correct. Absolutely. So this was the struggle. And as a matter of fact, really, when you look at it, I think one of the things that really made the most sense is that the way the states discipline, like whether it be lashes or money, you know, that is significant to try to standardize and create a common form of discipline, order, and so forth for the militia. But bottom line, it's necessary because when those folks come together, they can't, you know, you can't have, I mean, if you looked at the army and you were in, you know, a company formation and they were doling out the punishment because a lot of times, I don't know if they still do it, but a lot of times in the old days, they would actually, when people had to get punished, they would identify who's getting office hours, who's getting the court martials and who was doing, you know, restricted duties, what have you. Everybody was called out and are identified by name who was not getting off the base for liberty. No liberty passes for, because it was kind of a court of shame as well. It was public shaming in addition because, oh, you got in trouble and now you can't go. It's a shoot. I'm not sure if you ever heard, but when I joined the Marine Corps, you had to have permission to get married. And you didn't get liberty or leave, or you couldn't leave the base, you know, at any day and time. You had to have a chit to go off base to you know, enjoy yourself, to, you know, go eat or just to take, you know, time off. You had to have a liberty chit in the Marine Corps. So we're going into a break, so we'll come back and we'll kind of talk about this because I could have actually seen how the problems with the different states and how they would have used different disciplining, how that would have just became a huge problem. But we'll bring this all up when we come back. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So just the differences between the states, just the differences in discipline, the differences in tactics and so forth, those right there would really pose a problem. And those right there would actually become more of a, I would say, almost a stronger justification for having a somewhat of a standing army. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I was going to say, I mean, from my experience in the military, it would, the part about having shared administration for a certain time or for a certain amount, that you're just asking for trouble. You're just asking for trouble because you're going to build up loyalties on one side or the other, and then, yeah, you're going to have nothing but problems.
Well, and so I can see, because let's look at it this way. At this point in time, there were three definitive forces that had been created. They don't say anything about the Marine Corps, but the Marine Corps was actually created separately from the Navy. Because Congress created the Marine Corps, not the Navy said, we're going to create a Marine Corps. Does that make sense? Because if you look at, help me out here, how did the Air Force get created? Well, the Army said, we need an Air Corps, right?
Right.
And so the Army started buying aircraft and started supporting themselves with their own Air Corps because, well, the Navy had their own Air Corps and the Marine Corps had their own Air Corps and the Army didn't. And so, or I should say the Army didn't, but I mean, the politics abound in all of this. It's all about politics. And it's all about where we need more money to do these things. But the reality is that Congress did not create the Army Air Corps. The Army did. But the Navy did not create the Marine Corps. Congress created the Marine Corps. Because it was the only, because I think we talked about this before, it was actually the only legitimate force that they could afford to employ. Because to have a Navy, you had to have ships. And so they couldn't afford the ships. And to, you know, have the Army, you'd have to have the permission of the states to surrender the militia. And the states weren't doing that. So they created this kind of continental political, you know, hodgepodge that they kind of called the Army, but it was still the state militia. And even under the Articles of Confederation, I don't think anywhere in there where they actually created an army. I don't think. But bottom line was that they started, and actually, they had the ability to actually form an army and to fight and prosecute a war. But that came after the Articles of Association. And bottom line, when they couldn't afford and they didn't have the money, they didn't create the army, they didn't create the navy, but they did actually pay the Marine Corps to go steal ships. And so once the Marine Corps stole a few ships from Navy fleets and so forth, now we had a Navy. Now, there was other, I don't want to marginalize, there were some men that had ships that donated their ships to the Navy, but and that's because they were kind of a part of a state militia Navy. I mean, Rhode Island had a Navy. There were a few of the states that actually had a small little, you know, cadre of boats or ships that they would use for coastal defense, what have you. But Rhode Island wasn't willing to give up their ships to Continental Congress. The same thing with most of the states weren't willing to give up. They would, you know, they would deploy some to go in aid of Massachusetts, but to actually truly form the army, that didn't happen until later. And it's the same thing with truly forming the Navy. But they did have these pirates they called the Marines. Later on, the Army built up and developed as in-house this thing we call the Air Force today. Look at Space Force. Now, Space Force has been a part of kind of NASA and the Navy and the Army and the Air Force, the Navy, Marine Corps, Army, Air Force, have been, you know, developing pilots to go as astronauts and so forth. And so they just kind of formed the Space Force. But technically, to do that, they would need an amendment to create an Air Force, or they would need an amendment to create the Space Force. Does that make sense? Because the Constitution does allow the federal government to possess and create and maintain a Navy and to form an Army, not Space Force and anything else. So technically, the responsibilities of strategic, you know, strategic issues or missions should fall underneath the Navy. We didn't need to create these bureaucracies. And to your point, it took a while, you know, under this forced homogenization, because once the states created the Constitution, started working and started adding states, they didn't need, and at that point in time, they weren't necessarily engaging in a protective force until the true advancements or true march westward was beginning, where the territory started opening up and they took the cavalry out there to protect the people, the farmers and those people, because they weren't trained, they weren't capable, but they were supposed to be. But the federal government, we've covered this as well, the federal government continually maintained this cavalry out there instead of ensuring that every state would be able to protect themselves and do their job as a militia. So in other words, the federal government was deliberately maintaining this dependency and growing their presence as they went westward. This is why there were so many forts and stockyards and arsenals, or not stockyards, but, you know, arsenals, magazines, those types of things, all the way across the United States. So as we kind of look at what they're talking about here, the creation of the cavalry forced to homogenize, if that makes sense, because the militia, everybody coming in, they had to go under the federal, you know, the federal regs and all of this. The real advantage of this, in violating the Constitution, helped standardize, and the incentive for people to, you know, join and be involved was, it was a steady paycheck, right? I mean, hostilities, you know, in the West was, you know, you shoot, you join the cavalry, yeah, you could die, but hey, it was good pay, right? And it was a constant job. You didn't have to worry about, you know, running out of flour or the raining for your crops, that type of stuff. So those guys that wanted to kick butt and, you know, travel around and not own anything but just get a decent pay. In other words, these guys weren't freeholders. I wonder if they voted, you know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so, I mean, all of these types of questions, but bottom line, they, you know, what they did, even though it was a violation, there were some advantages of doing that. Because as we see today, the differences in the states and how the states wanted to have their autonomy, you can translate that into the services, right? Because the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, and now Space Force, and even DHS, because DHS is a force, it is a permanent standing army, just like FBI, just like Coast Guard. I mean, they may have, you know, under the Department of Transportation or their own department or what have you. But now you create what you call a political chaos between these different interests of these different political organizations. And I think that's what you were alluding to. But at the state level, you were alluding to that at the state level, but I'm just saying that that translated into even a bigger problem, because now everybody's getting their I'll call it competing interest. Why is it that we have every department in the Department of Defense, the Navy, Army, Air Force, and on, I'm sure Space Force, has these special operations teams? Why is it that everybody has special operations teams? Or better yet, and I don't know if I told you this, but as a paper, as you know, when you go through the staff college or what have you online or a correspondence course, the Marine Corps had these things, and I submitted a paper that basically said we need to get rid of the services and consolidate them so that we only have one administrative body. We don't need five administrative bodies and all these other things. And all we need to do is just change the missions. We got the strategic missions, and we got, you know, this mission. And so we don't have to duplicate everything, because all these stovepipes, it's just a huge waste of money. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir, it does.
But what would be the problem with that?
Centralized power.
Well, the problem is that it takes away the opportunity of the most ambitious people in the military ranks. It's these officers and politicians, because it takes away how many stars there's going to be. You have five branches of service. You have five separate administrators. You have five separate commanders. You have five separate, you know, administrative commands. And then you also have operational commands. I think you know that, right? You've got the general of the Army, the commandant of the Army. We have the commandant of the Marine Corps. And then you have these operational generals, CENTCOM, SOUTHCOM, or SOCOM, and so forth and so on, right? So the more operational centers, the more department. I mean, it's great for officers, because now they can get more stars. Yeah, there we go. And that's why they continually maintain these barriers, because if you consolidated that, you would probably cut down, at least on the administrative side, you'd cut, 25%? Or no, not even more than that, it'd be 80%. 80% of the stars and the staffing would go away, just on the administrative side. And by separating the operations and so forth, that everything would basically become consolidated. You'd even get consolidations there on these special things, these fringes and so forth. Anyway, long story short, as I look at what they're talking about here, they're bringing up some really good points. And as as they go through this, it's interesting that all the negatives against this kind of fell on deaf ears, because it looked like it all practically passed unanimously once it went through the delegations, right?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Okay, so as we move on, and let me kind of go down to the next segment that we want to cover. This is Mr. Gary, and this is on August 20th. And this is where Mr. Gary moved, quote, that the committee be instructed to report qualifications for the president and mode of trying the Supreme Court judges in cases of impeachment. The clause, quote, to call forth the aid of the militia, etc., was postponed till the report be made as to the power over the militia referred yesterday to the Grand Committee of the 11. So, in other words, they maintained this Grand Committee of 11 to kind of take care of some of these very specific issues. Are you with me at that point with Mr. Gary?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so go ahead and just keep reading on down through Governor Morris and the ultimate vote here.
Mr. Gary moved that the committee be instructed to report proper qualifications for the president and mode of trying the Supreme Court, Supreme judges in cases of impeachment. The clause, quote, to call forth the aid and of the militia, et cetera, was postponed till report should be made as to the power of the militia referred yesterday to the Grand Committee of 11. Mr. Mason moved to enable Congress to enact sumptuary laws. No government can be maintained unless the manners be made consonant to it. Such a discretionary power may do good and can do no harm. A proper regulation of excises and of trade may do a great deal, but it is best to have an express provision. It was objected to sumptuary laws that they were contrary to nature. This was a vulgar error. The love of distinction, it is true, is natural, but the object of sumptuary laws is not to extinguish this principle, but to give it a proper direction. Mr. Ellsworth, the best remedy is to enforce taxes and debts, as far as the regulation of eating and drinking can be reasonable. It is provided for in the power of taxation. Mr. Governor Morris argued that sumptuary laws tended to create a landed nobility by fixing in the great landholders and their posterity their present possessions. Mr. Gary, the law of necessity is the best sumptuary law. On motion of Mr. Mason as to sumptuary laws, New Hampshire, no. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, aye. Maryland, aye. Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, no. Georgia, aye.
Okay, so that's kind of an interesting twist that Mr. Mason had put in, this sumptuary law thing. And so, do you understand sumptuary laws? It's okay. Not really. Most people don't. It's kind of like creating regulations that restrict people from being able to do certain things, like luxury taxes or luxury restrictions. I'll give you a good case in point. Have you ever heard of the gas guzzler law?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you go out and buy a Hellcat, you get hit with a tax on buying that car, and you're penalized because you bought that car, because it is going to consume more gas than your average car. And that was considered a luxury of being able to do that. But that is an sumptuary law. And so when we looked at, Mason, kind of saying, we need to be able to do that. Do you see anywhere in the Constitution with the authority to do that?
Absolutely not.
And I've already given you a case that they're doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. So the point is, when you look at the color-coded Constitution that we have that identifies the direct violations that are within the Constitution itself, this line's being violated. I don't have a line for sumptuary laws. In other words, maybe they should have added that there shall be no, created this in the restrictions, in other words, Article 1, Section 9, that the federal government and state governments, and put in both 9 and 10, that there will be no sumptuary laws created by the federal government. There will be no sumptuary laws created by the state government. Because they were clearly opposed to it, but they just didn't enumerate not to do it. Now, the whole point is, if it's not enumerated, can they do it?
Exactly. That's what I was about to say. If you don't have the authority, it's no question that you cannot do it.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. And so when they create these pretended laws, because most people are ignorant, well, what do you mean they can't make that law? Because they don't understand that the laws that are being created, they actually have to have a derivative source of power, a derivative authorization that says you can make those types of laws. This is the problem I see throughout the states. This is what's rampant in America. The governments are making laws they have no authority to make. Again, this goes to the debt, as I started the show off. It's all about fraud. It's all about the color of law. Folks, this is why we go through this content. This is why we read these things to you, so that we can connect these dots for you. I can't tell you how important this little flag of sumptuary laws is, because it doesn't come up in the ratification debates, because the power to create sumptuary laws was not granted. So there's no point in debating it, because the whole Constitution was constantly being justified in the ratification debates that if it's not granted, they can't do it. And yet, look at today, all the different powers that they're exercising, that they don't have the power to do that. How is it that they're doing this? Because you and I, or I should say we the people, are so ignorant on the Constitution, we're just allowing this crap to happen. And until we stand up and say, you need to comply, you need to stay within the will wells of the Constitution. The day you do that is the day you get rid of all your problems. Now, some of the pains and the sorrows that you'd have to go through, like, you know, some of the SNAP, and people have to get jobs. People actually have to start doing things. Well, guess what? Minimum wage is going to be gone. Because no state, no government in the United States, at a federal, county, no state, no government has the authority in their constitution to establish minimum wage. So now all of a sudden it becomes free for all. Employers will pay whatever it's worth to them to get a person to do that job. And if they're not paying that, or that person's not happy with his wages, he'll get that job, you know, work for a few weeks and jump to the next job. If you want to have a good, stable workforce, then you treat them the way they deserve to be treated. But you can't enable bad behavior either. Okay, so corporations and companies, their profits will go down because they're, you know, people aren't going to be paying exorbitant prices because you're not paying the the high prices on labor. I mean, all of a sudden, we basically would fall into this huge depression. Not a depression like the depression, but what do you call that when you have inflation? There's an opposite word for inflation, where basically all of a sudden the value of money and a person's time goes up even though the dollar cost goes down. In other words, your gold, you'll get more out of your gold with a person than you do today.
I'm not sure. I'm not big on the economic theories.
Yeah, okay. But
I do realize that the crux of what you're saying to me, and this runs through everything that we talk about, is that all of these troubles and woes that we discuss all lead back to overreach of the constitutional authority.
Right, absolutely.
Because you wouldn't have corporations that would be able to oppress or repress, however you want to state it, their workforce if they weren't given government subsidies and regulations architected by the industry instead of regulation in the terms of the constitutional authority. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So the government's favoring these industries. So those industries have carte blanche to do whatever they want. And there's no recourse because they're being protected by the government. Where otherwise they would have to play on a fair playing field with their workforce if they weren't being subsidized by the government.
Yeah. So actually, let's look at it in addition to that. So when you're paying somebody wages, you're not just paying a person to work for you. You're having to pay the government for that person to work for you. You're paying an income tax. You're paying, or actually they pay the income tax, but you pay the Social Security tax. You pay all these other taxes and fees that they levy upon the employer. Those types of things would go away because those are not constitutional for the employer. The government gets out of the relationship between the employer and the employee. Now, if a person wants to offer benefits, I will say that when you have a financial reset like this, it will create, unless you have good, smart people, and I'm not the smartest guy on this at all, I think that you need to identify good, smart people, and you need to have thorough vetting so that everybody gets, you know, has delegates to get involved in how are we going to manage, or you know, how are we going to deal with all of these restrictions, these ceilings and these floors, right? You can't go under this price. You can't go over this price. These types of things, these types of regulations that they create, they go away because they don't have the authority to do them. And so it is best to actually let some, I would just say some smart economists that understand this, to really kind of help everybody move towards reducing, because there's no reason why we can't have families living on a single income anymore. You know, the only reason somebody would not live on a single income is because their desire of luxuries and opulence, that most people would be happy to, you know, send their kids to college, because that was the American dream. In the 40s and 50s, post-war, late 40s, early 50s, and going into the 60s, the American dream was, you know, every family was living off of one income. Their kids were going to school because they could afford that. They could afford their house. They could afford everything. But we weren't being flooded with all sorts of gadgets and gotta-have things. You know, and all of a sudden, the more technology offerings and all these other things, it creates... I'll just call it your disposable income goes down to nothing if you keep on being a spendthrift. And so those people that have to have the newest gadgets and those types of things, they're not saving money. But if you don't have a retirement plan and you realize that there is no retirement plan at all, then you are, you know, Aesop's Fables. You remember Aesop's Fables? Ever heard of them?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the ant and the grasshopper. The grasshopper was, you know, just flighty, just wanted to party and have fun, while the ant was storing food away from the winter. And so you're going to have people in society that are going to be grasshoppers, and you're going to have probably more people in society that are going to be ants, because they're pragmatic and they know they need to survive. That as nice as fun is, it has its place in time. And so we would go back to, you know, that type. But we weren't literally, in the 50s, we were nothing like they were in the 1780s, 90s, and early 1800s, where you really did shut down for the wintertime. Because we actually started opening up global trade to where we could actually have strawberries in the, you know, in the supermarket in the middle of the winter. So because of these trade agreements and so forth, that we were still, in many ways, some of that stuff was still within the confines of the Constitution. It's only when they started going well beyond this. But Social Security was one of the problems that they created. And that actually started taking more out of Medicaid, Medicare. All those types of things just started taking more out of an employer pays a lot more money than what the employee actually sees coming into his pocket, into his W-2 form. It costs the employer more money. There's L&I taxes, like unemployment. There's an unemployment tax that I think they pass some of that on to the employee, but the employer usually pays that too. That's why the employers don't like employees that use unemployment tax. So the point, I guess, is, which we're trying to cover because we're really out of time, is the fact that as they were kind of pulling things together, there were these ideas that were thrown out, like the assumption of debt. That actually made it into the congressional debates in the very first year or two. It was 1792, so 3 years. My point is, and actually it was at the end of the second year, my point is on this, is that as we look at the sumptuary laws, this was one of those things that Congress didn't even dare go down that path. They didn't want to cross that bridge at all because it wasn't necessary. At that point in time, it wasn't necessary, but we can see today how they've created those types of laws without the authority. This is why it's important to understand what we're dealing with. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.